Good morning. Good morning. We'd like to welcome everyone to this morning's study session from May City Council for Thursday, April 4th, 2013. Councilwoman Dina Higgins will not be here today, and she won't be joining us on the telephone. The first item on the agenda is item 1A, hear a presentation discussed by direction on the Gilbert Road Light Rail Extension Project. After this, we're going to switch items B and C because we have some people that have other appointments they have to get to. So we'll go A, C, and then B. Ms. Sorrell.
Good morning, Mr. Mayor, members of the council. We were, the last time we were here was late 2012 to kind of give you an update where we were with Gilbert Road. And now we're back with looking for your direction on some of the street configuration, the station locations, and the park and ride. So we have a full contingent of people up here to give the presentation. Ben Limmer and Wolf Grote with Valley Metro and Dan Clevenger with our transportation department so that we can answer and address your questions. So with that, we'll let Wolf and Ben start the presentation.
Mayor Smith, members of City Council, good morning. Thanks for this opportunity. We have three things that we'd like to discuss with you today, and we have recommendations that we'd like to move forward with. One is the location of stations. The second is the park and ride location, and then the street configuration, and that is number lanes and how the street looks for the two-mile stretch that we're looking at. As you all know, the Gilbert Road Light Rail Extension is roughly a two-mile extension extending east of Mesa Drive to Gilbert Road. We're going to be adding two additional stations, one new park and ride as part of this project. I should make a side note that last week at the MAG Regional Council, there was an action to include this project in the MAG Regional Transportation Plan, so that this project is now part of their funded program, and it's in a position for us to be able to move forward. With regard to stations, we have two locations that we've been looking at, Stapley and Gilbert Road. The decision that we're needing to make is more specific to where in relation to those intersections should these stations be located. And there's a number of factors that we looked at, including access by the users of the system, economic development potential, what kind of impacts we have to property, as well as connections to other transportation modes such as buses. The Stapley Drive intersection, we looked at three different locations for this station, and the recommendation that we're asking to move forward is a station location roughly about 500 feet east of the Stapley Drive intersection. And the reason for that is to minimize the impacts on businesses that are at that intersection, as well as taking advantage of economic development potential of the large parcels to the north and east of Stapley. The other location that we are recommending for a station site is just to the west of Gilbert Road, and the reason that we're recommending that location is to allow future flexibility for the light rail to be extended potentially either east or south on Gilbert Road at some point in the future. It also provides us good connectivity to the park and ride, which I'm going to be talking about here right now. We have two sites that we looked at for the park and ride. One is north and west of the Gilbert Main intersection, and the other one is south and west of the intersection. The north option provides about 850 space opportunity. The south option, about 700 parking spaces. Each of the sites also allows us for a bus turnaround that we'll need to have for connectivity to the rail system. And the model that we use to forecast demand for us estimates that we have initial, when we open up the facility, would have initial demand for about 500 spaces, but over a 20-year horizon, the demand could increase to as high as 850 spaces. And both of these numbers assume that we continue with the park and ride at Mesa Drive under the project that we're now constructing. So the recommendation that we're requesting to move forward with is the south option because it has the least impact on buildings and businesses It is a lower cost option. It has an acceptable access for both automobile and for buses, and it does accommodate our near-term parking demand, although over time we'll have to monitor that to see if maybe we might have to add additional space in the long term, which can be done potentially in a structure on the site. The next thing I'd like to move towards is the configuration of the street. When we came here to talk to you last fall, we had two options for your consideration at that time that we were going to take to the community. One of those was a four-lane cross-section that is two lanes of traffic in each direction. It provides for a left turn lane at intersections with signals, which were going to be roughly a quarter mile. It also has bike lanes as part of that, but in order to accommodate the four-lane section with light rail, there would no longer be any on-street parking on the street in that two-mile section. And it does require additional right-of-way in the vicinity of left where the left turn lanes are added and the traffic signals need to be at roughly the quarter-mile locations. And it's going to require roughly 15 feet. Today it's about a 100-foot cross-section, and we're looking at 115 feet. This is without a station. This is just with left turn lanes. The station would actually requires a little bit more space than that. The two-lane cross-section fits within the 100-foot cross-section, or the 100-foot right-of-way for the most part. It has one lane in each direction. It accommodates the left turn lane. It still has the bike lane. And it does remove parking at the intersections where you have the turn lanes, but in between there, if there is a desire, there can still be some parking on the street with the two-lane option. So as we looked at these options and we worked with the community on this, we recognized that there were, of course, pretty obviously there were some differences between these options, and they came in terms of property acquisition, traffic capacity for the street. There was some cost differential between the two options, and of course, I mentioned also the opportunity for parking was the primary differences. We saw that there were, because of some of the issues that we saw on this, we decided that we needed to look a little bit further, and we developed two hybrid options that were in between the two and the four lane. And the first one I'll call the base option, and that is primarily a two-lane through traffic, but at the two major intersections at Stapley and at Gilbert, it would be widened to a four-lane cross-section, about 700 and so feet either side of the intersection at those locations. We would still retain bicycle lanes all the way through with this option, as well as some on-street parking away from those major intersections. The other option that we also are looking at is one with the same thing as the base option, but to add roundabouts at two locations at Horn and at Harris. And again, we're looking at these options really to address the auto capacity and the right-of-way issues, and this is a balance between the two-lane and the four-lane. Just a little bit more about the roundabouts. The reason for the locations of the roundabouts, they're the half-mile points between the major arterials. You can see on this map that, it's, again, at Horn and at Harris. Also, there's a photo here. This is an example in Salt Lake City, an existing light rail system with a roundabout at the University of Utah. And there are some advantages to this. One is it does provide a little bit more auto capacity than the two-lane. It does allow for easier U-turns to be made because, again, you can't make left turns anywhere when you have light rail in place. It also does require crossing gates. There will be a couple of signals added for pedestrian movement whenever there is a pedestrian crossing, and it will require a little bit more right-of-way in the vicinity of the roundabout itself. So in order to understand the impacts of all these different options, we've kind of summarized all this in a table, and you can see all the different options and the kind of effect each one of them has. We looked at right-of-way, we looked at acquisitions, we looked at impact to existing buildings, the number of traffic signals, how much on-street parking could be retained if it's the desire to do that, and also looked at traffic throughput on Main Street. And the four-lane option, which shows the 24 to 28,000, is what you're seeing today on Main Street. So, again, I don't think I need to go through all this unless you'd like me to stop and go through, but you can see the numbers, you can see the differences. But this was really helpful to us in making a staff recommendation, and our recommendation is to go with the hybrid option with the roundabouts. Again, this provides more auto capacity than the two-lane. The roundabouts improve the traffic flow. It's less right-of-way than the four-lane, less cost than the four-lane, and it does preserve the opportunity for parking, should that be desired. As part of this process, we had quite a community outreach. We had a number of public meetings. We met individually with as many businesses as we could along the street. We actually about 70 out of the 110 we met with individually and contacted them individually, that is. And we had a number of neighborhood events and outreach opportunities. We had some feedback forms that we had. So we really tried to make sure we understood the pulse of the community before we made the decision. And actually, it was the community that helped us to come up with these hybrid options come up with a solution that hopefully will meet the best needs of the community. With that, Mayor, that concludes my presentation.
Okay. Questions? Vice Mayor.
I've been asking before this meeting to put a dollar value or, you know, cost, and I know there's been some discomfort because we don't know what that really will be, but when you make a big decision like this, you know, cost-benefit analysis, and so is there any way you can give me some range of costs that go with the, you know, with the hybrid versus the four-lane?
Mayor Smith, Vice Mayor Finter, yes, we can. I mean, our preliminary estimate for the four-lane option, which we've recently updated, was roughly $125 million.
And that's for 1.9?
Yes, and that's inclusive of all the costs, real estate, engineering, you know, all the costs that go with it. The cost for the two-lane, we haven't updated as recently, but I'm going to say it's roughly about $15 million less than the four-lane option. And the hybrid, of course, is going to be about roughly halfway in between the two. We are going to be updating as part of our next phase of effort. We're going to be spending a lot more time in preliminary engineering, get a lot better sense of some of the engineering aspects of this, and we will provide another estimate at the end of the preliminary engineering the engineering phase, which is going to take us about 6 to 8 months to complete.
As a follow-up, if I could. So, and I know there's been an effort, Councilmember Richens has really pushed for, you know, how do we incorporate shade and other design, you know, elements into these deals. So, when we look at that base cost or look at some savings by going with different options, the idea would be then maybe to see if we can capture some of the other desires in design. Is that right? Is that the approach? So I guess what I'm asking is, if we save a little money by going with a little narrow area, are we able to use that money, or is it anticipated to try and look at other aspects of this?
Mayor, Vice Mayor, that's actually been kind of our approach to this, is the opportunity. One, acquisition is more than just dollars, and I think we all know that, but it's really it's also businesses. Mm-hmm. And so we are very sensitive to how many businesses we're literally going to be dramatically affected by the four lane. And so while it'd be nice, it's a balance between four lanes and more acquisitions impacts businesses' property and each their actual business. However, the two lane affects businesses because it restricts so much traffic on Main Street that it cuts down the flow of traffic. And so we were in this dilemma of, you know, how to balance that out. But we would agree with you, and we are, we would like to continue to have these discussions with Metro, that we believe there needs to be some significant investment in the pedestrian experience, the shading, other elements along this section of the extension, you know. And we want to also make sure we look very carefully at the park and ride at Gilbert and Main too, because we would like this to be considered not just the end of the line, but we'd like to see it as a multimodal center so that we can run buses through there, we can have a park and ride, maybe, you know, or bike paths come together for a lot of other aspects. And so we want to make sure all those things are being considered as we begin to define the scope of the project.
And in that vein, as you go through this, and I think that the roundabouts definitely improve the business environment. I'm frustrated. I know everyone's frustrated when you go and sit at a left turn light and there's not a car in sight anywhere. There's not a train in sight anywhere. And you sit and you sit and you sit. And there's no doubt, and you sit. And then what you want to do is you want to run the red light. And some people have done that. And before they know it, there was a train right behind them. But the roundabout provides for, when there is that situation, provides for an even flow. And I think the roundabout mitigates that problem a lot, because you'll get people, especially on the half-mile lines, who will be willing to go up and go through the roundabout and go back, as opposed to sitting at a left turn lane to make a left turn light to make a U-turn. So I appreciate the roundabouts being included in there. As far as what the Vice Mayor said, I would agree wholeheartedly, which why I think we need to really look. I don't want to get into micro, but managing, but on this cutaway on the 100-foot, we do have, on both proposals, we have a detached sidewalk, which is supposed to allow us some landscape and some beautification opportunities, but you have a 6-foot sidewalk and only a 2-foot landscaping stretch. Not a whole lot you can do in 2 feet. You're gonna have a hard time planting trees and things like that in a 2-foot. And I think we really need to once again look at, do we have to have 6-foot? I know it's the preferred, probably is our standard. 4 feet, maybe go with at least a 3-foot, maybe even a 4-foot landscape strip, and that way you can, I would trade a foot or two off of a sidewalk for the ability to upgrade the landscaping along that road. Councilmember Richens?
Yeah, I think of the principle, I agree with you, Mayor. I think of the principle as eight feet of sidewalk and landscaping. I don't even know that you completely contained it in a strip. You know, let it vary a little bit.
Yeah.
Maybe some places you have eight feet of sidewalk and you have ample shade overhang from the business. Because if what we're trying to accomplish is a good pedestrian experience, engineering it, you know, as X number of feet for the landscaping and X number of feet for the sidewalk doesn't really get you there. You want, here's 8 feet of pedestrian experience. Some places are, because some of it you're going to want shade on the east side of the sidewalk, some on the, or I guess north and south, depending on the shade, you know, the time of year. And so I think, you know, let's have the flexibility somehow to say, hey, here's your pedestrian experience place, and let's start engineering stuff that really enhances that. And whether it's artificial shade or natural shade, I don't know that it matters. But it should also have the other pedestrian amenities that you might need, like, you know, garbage cans and bike racks and benches and all that kind of stuff. I think that's more the principle we're trying to accomplish.
Well, and I think if we look at it from the standpoint of, we're not just landscaping a road, but we're trying to mitigate the impact on businesses. And the nicer you make that pedestrian experience, the greater good you're going to do to the businesses.
Right.
You're going to make the area more attractive, and you're going to get people to come back there. So I think that's a good investment in the business and will somewhat offset some of the downsides of having restricted traffic and those kind of things. So, yeah, I agree with Councilman Richards. Look at that 8 feet as a space we can get creative with. And I know that creates a little bit more work, but we are creating a major – light rail is wonderful, I think, and I think it's proven it. But it also has costs. And one of the costs is there's no doubt that it creates a barrier that's more substantial than a median, and that affects businesses. That impacts business. So I think we owe it to those businesses along there that aren't right by a station to do what we can to upgrade that area so that they get a benefit from having the light rail go by there. And I think landscaping and a varying pedestrian experience is one way to do that.
Yeah, and I wouldn't want the space so rigid as not to allow, you know, maybe there's a restaurant there that wants to put a few chairs out front and encroach in that area. That's exactly what we're looking for, is that kind of pedestrian experience. Okay. Look at it as a linear plaza, if you will.
Yeah. Councilmember Summers?
Just to offer a slightly differing opinion, while I agree with the comments that have been made overall about how we might change this plan up to make it better, I'm a little concerned that we're trying to stretch downtown another 2 miles, and I just don't see that happening. When you restrict flow, even with down to one lane, there are going to be some significant restrictions, and we're talking about offsetting that by encouraging the pedestrian experience, which would work in a downtown area. That's why we selected this kind of style along Main Street in our downtown area, because it was built for a pedestrian experience. Wide sidewalks, the buildings are up against the street. My concern with this is this was built for the automotive experience. This is classic suburbia when you drive between you know, the other side of the church particularly, but from Mesa Drive to Gilbert Road. It's set up with parking lots and lots of parking on the street, and the rest of it in between houses. There's not a lot of that pedestrian experience there now, and the businesses are really designed for automobile travel and having that pass through traffic that's up and down this road. Where I work in downtown Phoenix, we have light rail through much of downtown, and the lanes through downtown, which is north the area, if you figure between Thomas and McDowell, is down to two lanes on both sides. And driving that every third day, I can tell you that feels awfully restrictive. And that is the widest plan that you guys have presented. It works, but it does feel pretty restrictive. I could see encouraging that walkable area around Stapley Drive, around Gilbert Road, within a quarter mile of where those stops are. But that, I hate to say it this way, I don't know that that really supports the existing businesses. It may support landowners who may look to take their property and reinvent it into some things that we'd love to see, some vertically integrated mixed use in a walking environment. But I think if we're concerned about the folks who are here, I would express some concern that we are going to forever change the character of this area from the automotive experience to the walking experience, and if we should think of that before we decide which way to go. And I think I'm on the fence on what I'd like to do, but it's definitely I like the roundabout option, but I really think that the four lane might be better for the character of this area, because we really want to focus that walkable area around downtown. It's just some thoughts, Mayor.
And to follow up on that, I don't disagree that this is primarily going to be an auto. I think the landscaping, other than provide, I don't think the primary benefit is to provide a walking. I think the landscaping will enhance the street scene, which I think is important to the businesses, mm-hmm. whether it's walk or whether it's a drive. I think if we just go in there and put stark landscaping or little tiny shrubs or whatever, it's going to be a double whammy. I think if we dress that up, then from an automobile standpoint, I think it benefits the businesses also, because you know it makes their front door more attractive. And how they use that, whether there's a little cluster like Councilman Ridgen says, where maybe once they park, there is a walking experience or not, I think it benefits from maximizing that landscape. And I think we just go to two lanes and don't do that, then I think we are creating a real, real burden. I also note they can tell you, I feel your concern, because I was very, very concerned about going from four lanes to two lanes. There's two things that give me pause to seriously consider this and even support it, and that is, number one, I think what we found through our change in our traffic strategy is that the real bottlenecks occur at intersections. And as a city, we've gone from widening streets the entire length of their run to leaving streets where they are, streets such as University, for example, which is a very narrow four-lane road with no parking, no, and really an unsafe bike lane in many, many cases, to where, like at Gilbert Road and those places where we've widened the intersection, we find that the throughput is maintained. Mr. Clevenger, you're shaking your head. Yeah, I drive to University, or you're nodding, not shaking, yawning, nodding.
He's falling asleep.
Yeah, he's falling asleep. And so I think that's why I like the hybrid plan, because I think that what we can do, and I'm hoping that we can alleviate the backup that might occur by narrowing it to two lanes, or reducing it, because we're really not narrowing it, we're just reducing it to two lanes, because we can get people through the intersections faster. The other thing is that in a lot of these areas, we're still maintaining on-street parking, which means that we do have the potential, if at some point in time we have space, we could go back, and I'm not saying we're going to do this, but I think we do have the opportunity to go back and put four lanes in if we eliminate on-street parking. At least I'd like to make sure that we maximize that street escape, so that if that's an option down the road and we find out that in a certain stretch this is not happening, perhaps we can go back and do that. because I don't see that, because it is an automobile, I don't often see people parking on Main Street between Horn and Gilbert. I can probably count on one hand, except for in front of like Bill Johnson's and Mata's when it was open there. But other than that, I just don't see cars parking on Main Street.
Mayor, and I brought that up in some, if I may, I just brought some that up in some meetings. About, is there, if we don't need that on-street parking, because it's not downtown, maybe we could utilize that for some better traffic flow. But I guess there was ardent defense of... Pretty strong defense of on-street parking by some of the businesses there, or
And that's kind of a conversation with some of the businesses. Sometimes,
well, the idea I think was to stripe it, see how it works, but always have the option that if we wanted to, we could go back and eliminate that on-street parking and replace that with a lane of traffic.
So the way we, I think, contemplated this, and correct me if I'm wrong, Dan, we took the intersections and went back 750 feet on the four lane, or how far back did we go?
Mayor, the 750 isn't necessarily a hard number.
Right.
We need it more on the downstream side so we can transition
back into
the one lane. On the approach, you could be shorter.
My point, well, what I'm suggesting actually is that what the council's concerned about the bottlenecking is that we may want to look as, try to be as liberal as possible at the four lanes at the intersection as far back as we can go, and try to minimize it. And also, just being sensitive to the impact it may have on businesses, but if we can maximize that, it's pretty far, then that helps, I think, with that capacity. The idea is to load them up into the intersections and get them into the left turn lanes and to get that flow going.
Right.
Okay.
And that's the great thing that the roundabout does, is it doesn't back traffic up.
Right.
They can move right around and get there. Councilor Kavanaugh.
I think, Mayor, I support the hybrid option with the roundabouts, because I think it provides really all the advantages for concerns that have been expressed in the community. It creates the best opportunity for multimodal transportation in a successful manner, especially like Councilmember Richens' comments about treating the sidewalk and landscape area basically as a canvas that can vary in down the street. I know there are certain minimum standards we have to meet for ADA purposes and things like that, but I think there are opportunities where variation and shade can produce a safe but more pleasant pedestrian experience. And so that's why I think the hybrid option really is the best, to help preserve options for bicycles, cars, pedestrians in a safer way, and in a way that's less frustrating than we've seen in other areas where light rail is. And many of us have experienced the roundabout example in Salt Lake or other communities where it works well. So that's where I'm coming from. Thank you, Mayor.
Vice Mayor?
I was reflecting on Mr. Summers' comments, and about the auto-oriented kind of configuration. So currently today, I'm always the observer of the obvious. We have big, wide four lanes, big sidewalks, and we have a dead and dying area. And this comes from the guy that used to represent that area for years and have struggled with openings and then businesses closing. So continuing to do things the same old way doesn't make a lot of sense. And so that's why I'm leaning towards the hybrid option. And I drive that every day. I'm glad to hear others recognize there's not a lot of on-street parking. I never picked up in our briefings that we may have that option of looking at on-street parking and then having the option of maybe changing into a lane. I think that's a great option to evaluate. So I feel a lot better just with that piece of information.
Uh-oh. Clevenger's sitting there now. He's worried because I've become a traffic planner. I just look at the space. You got 10 feet for a parking space, and you know that asphalt's going to be there. It would seem like you, and 12, almost 13 feet for a lane on a two thing.
Mayor, one of the concerns would be typically we'd have about 8 feet for a parking space, and we normally need about 11 for a through. Yeah. So we have to be careful with that. And then
I think on the cross cut, though, I think you dedicated 10 for, or maybe I was walking it around.
And then we've got a bike lane as well, so there might be some compromises there. We'll just need to, if we want it to be flexible, we'll have to give it some thought.
Oh, I'm sorry. Doesn't say how much it is.
Yeah, Mayor, also the one...
Oh, yeah, 10-foot for a left turn lane when you're turning left. So I figure that if you add 10-foot and 12.75, that you're going to have 12.75 going through, and that means... Because what you did is you eliminated a the parking lane to create the left turn lane. So that's where I came up with the 10-foot. Right. And I know you may pick up a foot or two there, but as long as there's space there, we can make it work. Councilor Summers.
Different question along this line. RPTA, are we going to maintain some kind of local bus service along Main Street where light rail is? I would assume we would, because light rail stops are farther apart than rail.
Right.
Okay, so does the one-lane option have bus pullouts already built into the plan? Because it's not reflected on this.
Mayor, Councilmember Summers, at this point, we don't have them designed this. I mean, that's a lot of the things that you're talking about today really are things that we can address during the design as far as the pedestrian space, bus pullout areas, opportunities to maximize traffic throughput with the space that we have. All those things will be addressed, I think, in the design part of this. And right now, what we have as a concept over the next 6 to 8 months, we're looking at preliminary engineering that will really help define some of the specifics of this project. And we'll work very, very closely with the city staff to make sure that we meet the needs that you all are addressing today and the needs of the community.
Hearing where the council is, clearly it sounds like the hybrid option with roundabout seems to be what the majority is going for. So in that vein, I think trying to think how you move traffic back and forth, there's nothing more frustrating than getting behind a bus that's stopped on the side of the road and you can't move. So making sure that we have ample bus pullouts along that hybrid option that are long enough so that they can try to get up to speed before they get in front of me would be great.
Noted.
Okay. Any other questions or comments?
Thank you.
I think you got the input.
Yep. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. All right. Now we're moving to 1C here. Presentation on the Topaz Regional Wireless Cooperative. And we'll turn it over, Mr. Brady. You can introduce our presenters, including our special guest this morning.
Right. So we have with us today Mr. John Cross, town manager in Queen Creek, but he is also the chairman of the of Topaz, and Randy is also here from our communications department. So I think they're going to kind of dual team present the presentation today. Is that correct?
Yes.
Go ahead, Randy.
Thank you, Chris. Morning, Mayor, members of the council. As Chris said, I'm Randy Thompson, the communications administrator for the city. And with me this morning is John Cross, who's the chairman of the board of directors for the Topaz Regional Wireless Cooperative and town manager for Queen Creek.
Mayor, Council, thank you for your time this morning. I really appreciate the opportunity of being here. I have the wonderful benefit over the years of being asked to volunteer on a number of different activities and sometimes boards and commissions. And I got to tell you, this has been one of the more interesting volunteer experiences for me over the last 5 years. And I'm very pleased to be here with you today because we have some information we'd like to share with you about the progress and the update of what's happening with this particular group. On the slide in front of you is some information that goes right to some very specifics with respect to activities that have occurred over the last 9 months. What I want to do is depart just a little bit from the slide and provide some more context about the information that exists in front of you. And I want to go back in time just a little bit. January 26, 2012 was a real key date from my perspective as chair of this group because it was on that date that the TRWC board and the RWC board adopted a joint resolution, very significant, and we were recognized by the Arizona District Attorney's Office for that joint resolution, as a matter of fact, in an effort to continue to cooperate, collaborate, and communicate on issues that move this region forward from a public safety standpoint. That particular resolution had 7 objectives in the resolution, and one of the outcomes from one of those objectives in the resolution, a key outcome, was reconvening a smaller group of the two boards in a couple of joint strategic planning sessions. Very, very important because it's very key that we continue to communicate with each other with respect to the logistics and capital planning of a lot of the resources that are sometimes very limited in the region for all of the issues we have to tackle. So that outcome produced two very important meetings, strategic planning sessions, as we call them. And the goal of those strategic planning sessions was to create a strategic communications plan that identified various tasks and assignments that both groups would work together towards over a period of time. These things don't happen overnight, as you know, towards continuous improvement and collaboration. And another outcome that came from that particular process was two working groups that were formed, importantly, one on governance, and then another working group on the technical aspects. And under the governance subcommittee of this group, and I'm sort of drilling down into the weeds a little bit for you, but I think it's important for you to have this context, Mayor and Council. The governance committee, we felt that, you know, it is important to re-examine where we are today. 5 years have gone by since the initial creation of the TRWC, what progress has been made. Can we re-examine, are there issues relative to the overall governance structure that we can continue to improve on? And this governance subcommittee is currently meeting. They're actively looking at some different and various options with respect to overall governance. And it doesn't necessarily automatically default for a rejoining of systems. Governance itself, from my particular perspective, shouldn't be, and I don't think in this particular case, is a barrier to the logistical and operational characteristics of the system. Now, work is scheduled with that particular committee yet to go, probably another quarter or so with respect to the recommendations and the fully fleshing out of those recommendations. And we've got some very key people involved in that subcommittee. I think your fire chief, Chief Beck, is involved, as well as Gary Bradbury, the fire chief of the Rio Verde District, which you all know very well as well. And they'll be making recommendations to the TRWC board here very shortly, and we would expect them to do the same to the RWC. Now, on the technical side, there's developing strategies and options. And one of the things that has been very important to me as chair, frankly, in this particular area is to ensure that we have the appropriate and responsible level of redundancy that exists in the region for public safety, but we're not prematurely doubling up on very expensive pieces of infrastructure that we don't need to do and expend, because the resources are limited and we have to be as responsible as possible about them. And this is key within this particular technical committee, and it mirrors back to one of these seven objectives or goals in the resolution, where both groups are sharing their technical and strategic roadmaps for their capital improvements program. I guess in summary, with respect to this particular slide, my own perception of this in terms of the working relationship with the RWC is extremely positive. I know the executive directors meet on a regular basis. There seems to be, from my perspective, a lot of collaboration, joint planning, and a lot of discussion regarding the facilities, much of which I've already talked about. And on our side, and I know on the RWC side, there's been a pretty concerted effort for involving operational level stakeholders throughout the entire planning process. But you know what? There's always room for continuous improvement on these particular issues, and we can't be complacent with respect to that. And I'd like to go ahead and move to the next slide to talk about that. One of the issues we've been working on is expanding and enhancing our user group and stakeholder input. This slide, I've got some updated information to share with respect to this particular slide. This speaks to the future with respect to this group coming together and meeting, and in fact they have already met just a couple of days ago, the user group. The chair has been established. We believe and have a lot of confidence that the group is not only off and running, but they're involved with a fairly significant amount of self-direction, which is important, I think, with respect to the outcomes and issues they'll be bringing forward to our board. And the group's plan is to meet monthly, and their next month's meeting will be discussing a lot more about education of how the system and the various parts work, be more discussion even on the VHF and the digital systems and how those particular pieces of the technology interface and can move the region forward collaboratively. So with that, I'm very pleased to see this progress made as chair. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have at the end of the presentation, but I think at this time, in the interest in your time, I'll turn it over to Randy maybe to go into some more of the technical aspects. Thank you.
Thank you, John. We'll switch gears a bit now and go on to some of the network improvements since the last time that I spoke with you. We put up a new radio site out at the site of Fire Station 219 to improve the network that connects our various radio sites together. We also moved into the radio site that we developed jointly with the Department of Public Safety up on Thompson Peak. That's our primary backup site for the city. We're also working on improving the coverage on the west side of Phoenix by developing a new site or moving into a site that was abandoned by Arizona State University on Shaw Butte. So that should improve the, in particular, the coverage for law enforcement when they work on the west side. And then as part of our upgrading of the equipment that connects some of the fire stations to city services, data, fire alerting, and telephone, we've installed some new microwave radio equipment. A quick couple of administrative items on the TRWC. The executive executive director was that position was formerly filled by Dale Shaw when he was an employee of the city. He's still filling that role, but the need for an executive director was identified. Job requirements were developed in collaboration with many of the stakeholders. And at the moment, though, pending the outcome of the governance discussion that Chairman Cross spoke about, that recruitment has actually been put on hold.
And I, maybe I'm asking the obvious, is that figuring that the job description, because of the relationship or the structure may change, you anticipate that could be one of the results of the governance group? Okay, so that's an option that's being, is on the table or being actively considered?
Yeah, Mr. Mayor, that's correct. Again, keeping all options open with respect to whatever recommendations might come forward. I think the thought is if there is an interest to head in a particular different direction, it may affect that particular position. So it's there's some flexibility in allowing us to be able to wait a little bit with respect to that, and it's not hindering our operations and the work that's being done currently with the TRWC.
Okay.
The TRWC board adopted their fiscal year 13-14 budget on February 12th. There was a slight increase in labor cost, mostly due to the full-time nature of the executive director role, and then a slight increase in non-labor cost as well. We've got some upcoming events. Many of you probably heard over the years about the topic of rebanding in the 800 megahertz band. This was to address interference by Sprint Nextel sites. Because of our proximity to the Mexican border, we're in the last wave to be rebanded. That should be coming up in the next year or two. The frequencies have finally been, various border issues have finally been resolved. So we're hoping we can move ahead, get that behind us.
I'm fascinated. Is that because of what the Mexicans use on their side, that there's some overlap there?
That's exactly the issue, Mayor Smith, right.
All right.
And then we've got an upgrade of the voice radio network coming up in the 2016 timeframe to replace some of the aging equipment. In fact, I believe I'm scheduled to be back with you next Thursday morning to talk about that in more detail. And then last but not least, we've had a few issues with quality of some of the equipment that we used. We've escalated that to the management of the vendor, and they are being responsive and working through those issues with us. One of the other things that we wanted to report some progress on is the fire department received a grant to purchase some new portable radios and new vehicle mounted radios that will cover two bands, which will avoid firefighters having to use two separate radios in some areas. Those have now arrived, and we're working on the programming of those radios and in preparation for deployment. And then the chart just shows
those switch toggle that we talked about a couple weeks ago.
Yes, it's the switch on the top of the radio, and
and those two bands would be 800 megahertz to VHF.
That's correct.
Okay.
Oh.
So that radio right there, which is that's the type that we are purchased and are putting.
Yes.
So that can handle both 800 megahertz and VHF.
Yes.
Okay.
All right, and I'll real quickly cover our performance measure.
Let's get back here because I think I got a couple questions too. Because this is a confusing issue to me. Just so you know, and I've heard so many different things, and I'd like to know. So we meaning TRWC has 800 megahertz. The law enforcement non-hot zone, and hot zone would be what, an incident, a specific incident, or how do you define that?
Probably the fire department would be best to address
They would define what is a hot zone.
Right.
Okay. So we're on 800 megahertz as our standard either way.
Yes.
Now, in the rest of the system, the RWC, they're on 800 megahertz normally, but then they switch to VHF in a hot zone?
Yes, that's correct, Mayor.
So do they have that same, I'm assuming they have to carry the same kind of toggle switch radio?
They do have some of those, or most of those same radios at the present time, is my understanding.
Well, I mean, how else would they switch from 800? And I got two firefighters here who can...
Two radios.
They use two radios?
That's the alternative.
In some cases. You have the toggle?
We have a toggle.
Okay. So, but you have the same thing, 800, and when you go into a hot zone, you switch to VHF?
Yeah, I was just... showing Councilmember Richens how you work, at least in Phoenix, the B switch is hooked up to what we call the KDEC, which is 800 megahertz.
Okay.
But if we have a hazardous incident, we need to switch to VHF, which is the ADEC, and we'll switch that to A alpha. And we'll use that on fires, hazardous materials incidents, and heavy rescue incidents. Anything that's going to put us in a hazardous situation.
So when you go into that situation, they say we're on alpha now. Switch to
right.
Alpha.
Last night we went to a house fire. We were dispatched A5.
Now when our guys go out, and let's say they go across the border, which is when they'd have this, into Tempe or Chandler or whatever, I'm assuming it would be the same protocol. How would that work with these new toggle switches?
I would assume it would be set up the same thing. So your KDEX for 800 megahertz will be on the B channel, and the A channels will be...
Yes.
Is it going to be set up the exact same as Phoenix?
Those are set up the same, to my understanding.
Because as I remember Dan, when he was here 2 or 3 weeks ago, explained the protocol, when there's a call that goes in and it's on the RWC or the Phoenix dispatch, the unit is basically sent out and switched, and Dan's back there, correct me if I'm wrong, is informed to switch to the Phoenix dispatch channel en route. Right? And Dan's coming up. In route. I want to make sure I understand how this works, because I know there's a lot of discussion. We hear a lot more about how we interact between the two systems. So in route, our units would be put in contact with Phoenix Dispatch at that time before they get to the scene. Is that generally how it works?
Mayor, that's correct.
And at that time I would assume that now that they're on Phoenix Dispatch, that you would have the same instructions that you get when you go to a fire because you're working for Phoenix Dispatch as to the alpha.
If it's set up, okay. It's set up the same.
And now our guys, our units, with that toggle switch could then toggle over to alpha, right?
Correct. Currently, until we get these radios in place, they physically get a separate radio. But as soon as they get dispatched from our dispatch center on our 800 megahertz channel 1, they move over to the VHF Phoenix channel, whatever it is that they get assigned to it on that VHF system, and enter communication with Phoenix Alarm. At that time, arriving on the scene and then talking directly with the units in that Phoenix system.
And now, just to go back to make sure I don't understand, once these are operable, meaning they've been programmed, then our firefighters won't have to use two radios anymore. They can carry one radio and they can toggle between the RWC VHF and our 800 megahertz?
That's correct.
But once they get on the scene, they're in Phoenix dispatch now, so they're not talking to our people, so they would go to wherever the Phoenix
correct.
Dispatch tells them to go.
That's correct. They get the dispatch address. That information comes up on their MCT in the vehicle, so they don't have to try to remember that address so they can get routed in there. But all the communication after that initial dispatch from our dispatch center is all done through Phoenix Alarm when we're assigned to in the
okay,
Phoenix system.
And now, without those, we have to carry two radios.
Correct.
Is that what I'm hearing?
Correct.
And then that's what I think I heard now. But with those radios, we only have to carry one radio.
Correct.
Okay.
In addition to the handheld radios, Randy's also in the process of programming the mobile radios, the radios inside the vehicles, the hardwired radios. Because right now, we have two radios in the trucks, the VHF radio and an 800 radio. And Randy will be replacing all of those with the dual band radios as well.
Now, just so I can understand, once we get on scene, who talks? I'm assuming you have I don't know what the term is, incident commander,
yes,
whoever that might
be. Yes, an incident commander and an order model to all the communication.
Now, they, who talks to dispatch and who talks to the people on the scene in a fire incident?
The incident commander, as you pointed out, is primarily the only one that talks to the dispatch center.
Okay.
Everybody else on the scene talks to the incident commander.
Okay.
So as an example, we have engine 7 gets dispatched over to Tempe. As soon as they get the dispatch, they switch over. They acknowledge through the Phoenix dispatch system that they're en route. So we've got that acknowledgement done. That's pretty much their last communication they ever have with the Phoenix alarm system until they clear the scene. The rest of the communication is done. They announce they're on scene. All their communication after that is done with the incident commander.
Okay, now these units allow to easy, and that's, is that why we go to VHF?
Yes.
For better communication between the individual firefighter and the incident commander?
Well, we go to VHF now because that's where, when we go.
Well, I know, but I mean, trying to understand why Phoenix has done VHF. They think that's more effective on the scene between the incident commander and the individual firefighter?
In a hazard zone situation where you may have a critical incident where you've got to change strategies immediately, and their radio system is different than ours, they do believe that their communication is going to be better and less chance of any kind of breakdown in communication if they stay on VHF for a hot zone incident.
Okay, but when our... Because what we're talking about is how these two work together.
Right.
When our firefighters go over into Tempe and they're in a hot zone, their incident commander's on VHF, our individual firefighters now are connected to him or her through that
yes.
toggle on their unit, and they can communicate on VHF, right?
Yes.
Okay. With only one radio, not with two radios.
Yes.
Okay.
Mayor,
am I missing something?
The reason for the switch, Mayor, is 800 is an exceptional system
yeah.
for interoperability. It really stinks, and I'm changing that word, in a hazard zone because it has issues with particularly getting in buildings
right.
in some hazard areas. VHF works much better. There are a number of departments when the switch to 800 megahertz was made that were experiencing lost
right.
firefighters because of the communications.
Go ahead, Vice Mayor.
Just, buildings.
Yeah, sorry, sir. Just to... look at it, if we could, with Chief Stubbs. Now, look at it with Phoenix or Tempe coming to Mesa, because I think some of the issue is 800 megahertz VHF. VHF safety, you know, connectability. There's worries that firefighter injury or death could occur because they can't communicate. So these units coming to Mesa, we are on a strictly 800 megahertz system. How does Tempe do it with the hardware? How are they doing it now to come to us?
They do the same thing. I don't know if they've got dual band radios yet, but if they have, they'll do the same toggle. But before that, they had two radios as well when they went to 800. So when they cross over Price Road for a medical incident or a fire incident, they use the 800 megahertz system. It's just exact opposite of what you just described, Mayor, when we go over to Phoenix.
Right.
They acknowledge on the Phoenix system. They switch over to 800. They talk to our alarm after that. Then they talk to the incident commander, and they're operating in the 800 system on fire incidents, medical incident, whatever it is, because that's what we use over here.
And there is lies some of the rub is because Phoenix, the west side, uses the VHF, which they feel is a much safer hazard zone system, and Mesa is on an 800 megahertz that may have some challenges, and thus there's some rub there, right?
That's a fair statement. It's a true statement. The thing that I don't want to get lost in the wash here is that the two systems between Phoenix and Mesa in the 800 are quite a bit different because of the topography and the size and everything from the Phoenix system. I worked, as well as you did, Councilmember, our Vice Mayor Finter, with the VH system that we had, and we had a lot of limitations with that system, with building coverage and things like that. Our 800 system that we have in place now far exceeds the capabilities of that system. Our in-building coverage is far greater than it was with that VHF system. But there is no perfect system.
Well, and as Craig Brown, I've heard someone say that Phoenix is actually expanding their use of 800 for non-hot zone.
They use the 800 for all non-hot zone.
They use it for all non-hot zone. Yes. And then I've heard that, then you get into the age-old about our ability to talk to DPS and Maricopa County, which are on totally different systems. But I heard somewhere that DHS, which has basically been on a UHF-type system because they're long distance, are moving to 800 in metro areas.
It's my understanding as well.
Okay. So 800 seems to work when you're because you can play off cell towers or whatever we do the 800. The question then, and this is what I've always wondered, is this a question between the areas working together, or is this a should we get a VHF for hot zone and that capability? Is that something that's been discussed in TRWC, in the Topaz? Or is that something that, Chief, you think that do you believe we're adequately covered with our 800? And I don't know the difference between, hot zones, whether we have different types of structures here, different things, without getting into that. Is that something that's been discussed?
Yes, we've had several discussions probably over the last 6 to 8 months at a regional deal through two different committees, the Regional Operating Consistency Committee, which is the assistant chiefs of the Valley Fire Departments to get together to talk about consistency in all of our communications and operations, and through the Life Safety Council, which is all the fire chiefs of the Valley. We've had discussions probably close to a year now on the interoperability and the consistency. Going back to your first question, does it operate well? We haven't had any major failure systems with the 800 within our hot zones, but there has been some limitations, especially on the voice transmissions that you get through the face piece, and the digital signal that you get sometimes is garbled. You don't have that when you have a VHF system and it's just radio to radio kind of thing. So there are some limitations. The bigger limitation from the consistency side that we're working on is the procedures and what between the two dispatch centers, if you do have that emergency, if you've got a critical incident like a roof collapse or something like that, and you've got to get firefighters out, it's going to be a lot better with one radio, but with two radios is where's that button? Where's that emergency button? Is everybody going to do the right thing? Are they going to, when they hear a Phoenix alarm person, is the same communication? So there were a lot of failure points, potential failure points, if something really goes bad. And that's what we're working on, is we're trying to eliminate that. And if everybody in the Valley worked in a hot zone, was on the same type of radio system, then that eliminates most of that.
About in a hot zone.
In a hot zone.
Okay.
Because you don't typically have that critical. Anything can happen on any scene anywhere. But when you're working outside, you're working on a medical call, and you're working in a non-hazard area, there's usually a lot more time to make adjustments. Right. When you're working in a hazard zone, as Councilmember Summers talked about, a hazmat zone, a fire, or a tactical rescue, and something goes bad, you usually have nanoseconds to fix it. And that's the part that we're concerned about from the region, is that small instance in there, if everybody's not on the same page, you could have a bad outcome.
Okay, but I'm a little bit confused again. If we go to this and we're on the VHF system through that toggle, does that eliminate or mitigate the situation you're talking about, or does that not still create a consistency issue?
It helps us considerably when we go west of Price Road, but as the Vice Mayor pointed out, when
they come
Phoenix here. System comes here, now, again, they're on a system. So we've got a group of firefighters in the valley that basically on one side of Price Road or the other that constantly have to move, navigate between two different radio systems and remember what procedure from a dispatch side, who they have to talk to and different things like that. That's the rub. The far east side and the far west side of the system rarely get a blend of these two systems, so they're always on one system, and it's not as much. But we've got five major departments right down the heart of the valley here that constantly move back and forth in these. And the concern I have, just to answer your question a little while ago, from the operations chief in there, I have concerns about the individuals having to use two different radio systems and remember in that critical moment of what they're supposed to say and who they're supposed to say it to.
But getting back to it, if Tempe and Chandler, for example, had a dual band or multi-band radio, that would eliminate that problem, right, having to use the two radios.
It would go a long way towards that.
I know it's not the optimal
correct
solution,
yes,
but I'm trying to figure out. It seems to me that we have by moving to these radios, we've taken a giant step to eliminate the issues for our units going into the other ones.
Absolutely. There's without a question, you're 100% on. This is a giant.
If we're on the same VHF channel as the incident commander, and we're in Tempe or Chandler or even Phoenix,
correct,
we're on the same channel, right?
And we were able to do that with the two separate radios. We're still on that same channel and frequency. It's just
well, I know,
a matter
but
of,
having two
exactly
radios versus one radio, exactly. I can understand why that's a big deal.
Right, and then Dan, and we talked about this recently when we were talking about our public safety capital programs,
and I think I asked the question about what does it take to bring VHF into Mesa. And I think that's something we're going to visit about next week, about how we could, there's like a mobile solution to that to
yes
allow for the concern about if there's a hot zone in Mesa, that concern about 800 megahertz versus VHF. There may be some solutions that we could propose.
Is that a Mesa solution or would that be a Topaz solution?
Well,
because once again, those are
the region
different.
Well, the idea is when you come in, is there not like a mobile solution, Randy, that allows you to put that outside of a building or structure? Well, we've had to do in Mesa, we've actually treated the buildings so that made 800 megahertz functions.
Right.
But there may be an other solution that I thought we discussed as far as a capital.
And that we'll talk about that as a capital thing. But the idea is that we are at least discussing and talking about that as a potential solution. I mean, we don't have to solve the problem today. I just
correct
want to know.
Yes,
I just want to know if we're talking about it.
Yes, there are. There are. I don't sit on these boards, but I know there's some communication going on there. There is a group of Mesa people and Phoenix people dealing with this issue that Mr. Brady just talked about, talking about the mobile repeaters. We just did a tour, and Randy was over there with us. We toured the Phoenix VHF system last week, their infrastructure, to see what it would take to bring the Mesa side up to something similar. And Mayor, as you pointed out, having the one single radio, I think, adds an element of safety to our crew members. But even with that, with the two different systems, there's one lacking element that I'm still concerned about, and that's when that emergency button is pushed. Right now in the Mesa system, when that's pushed, there's an alarm that goes off in the consoles of our dispatch center, and there's a radio alias that comes on, and we know it's firefighter 4 position on engine 12. We know. It narrows the scope down of who's lost or who's trapped.
Right.
When we cross over into the Phoenix system, when we push that button on the VHF, they get an alarm, but the alias doesn't track as well. I don't know if these new systems will allow us to do better tracking on that, but that's one big area right now. And it's the same thing when Phoenix comes over here. Our alarm will get an 800 push on an emergency button from a Tempe unit. They just won't know where
exactly
it is. And again, that goes back into those fragile seconds you have at that beginning
uh-huh
to make a difference. So there are still some concerns. We've had numerous meetings with the Phoenix group in the last 3 months. We're continuing to have meetings. We've got regular meetings set up about every couple, 3 weeks. Randy's been very helpful with us with any time we need any kind of information. Again, we set up this meeting to look at the Phoenix system just, you know, about 10 days ago and call Randy and said, can you come? And Randy dropped what he did, and he came over with his crew, with his group, and toured that. So there's a lot of work being done.
So if I can just summarize, because we could probably spend all day on this. If I could summarize, one of the questions, as the Vice Mayor brought up, is should we seriously look at VHF as part of our hot zone approach or as part of our protocol. And the other thing is what we're losing is the ability to, especially in emergencies when that button's missed, to specifically hone in as to exactly who that belongs to, and that you lose that. Even though you can talk, correct, when you go across the borders, you lose that one element, which I can see how that could be considered an essential element. And those are the two major things that we lose, in addition to the two radios if you don't have the dual band and that kind of thing. Is that
I would say from the operations standpoint, from my viewpoint, you summed it up very accurately.
Okay. All right. Councilor Cavanaugh.
Thank you. These issues had extensive discussions before our public safety committee, and speaking with permission of my public safety colleagues, I guess our conclusions after our recent discussion really can be summarized in this way. The divorce between the two systems generally has not produced beneficial results. We know there were reasons for it, and our committee suggests those reasons get put in the parking lot by both groups and to move forward. Our committee is in strong support of the efforts to work towards a better governance structure, agreements between two systems, because the end result in that is going to be a safer system for our users, a safer system for the public. And again, the committee also, I think, was in support of the idea of having your end users participating in your working groups. And it's not that the team members can include, it's like, yeah, they should include or they shall include. And that was, you know, I think that that sentiment stood out very strong and clear in terms of our committee discussions. I appreciate the efforts that have occurred since that time. And I know that that our committee is going to continue to watch and monitor this very closely. But that's kind of where we were coming from. We appreciate the purchase of the new radios with the toggle switch that addresses that issue. But we think the underlying issue is we've got to go back and explore that governance thing, because as our committee said, we were using marital status terms. There needs to be mediation and a marital reconciliation of the groups. And so that's, again, I'm just speaking on behalf of my colleagues from the Public Safety Committee. Thank you.
Mr. Cross, maybe you could address, because when you're saying there have been talks, there have been discussions, just so we know some of the issues that were brought up. As the chair of Topaz, give us a real status as to what those.
Well, Mr. Mayor, council members, from my perspective, they've been progressing extremely well. In fact, one of the things that was very important to me and the former RWC chair, Charlie Meyer, a couple of years ago, was having quarterly meetings with the chair, vice chairs of the two boards, and making sure that we're both tracking this communication protocol within our respective boards and groups to ensure that as much stakeholder involvement as possible is occurring. From the governance perspective, there's a lot of different options that perhaps exist. One of the things that we want to be cognizant of is make sure that there's a thorough understanding of really what the outcomes of each one of those particular options are going to be, and is it going to realistically achieve the goals and outcomes the entire region is really looking for, because there's not a perfect technological solution that exists today with respect to the communication.
Wouldn't the three options, you got two separate groups, one region. Mm-hmm. Am I oversimplifying by saying there's three options? One is for Topaz to merge back into RWC, the other one's for RWC to merge into Topaz, and the third would be to create a regional, truly regional system, much like we do on many other things with MAG and everything, which means that both of those mold into a regionally governed system that is neither a Topaz or an RWC, it's a regional system. And I'm assuming that in any of those there are hardware and technological issues that would have to be overcome, and it would cost something because somebody's going to have to change some equipment, and there's going to have to be some kind of meshing. Is that?
Mr. Mayor, you're absolutely correct. I think you did an excellent job summarizing the options. If it's outcome-driven with respect to a clear understanding of both sides, and I think that's really the expectation of this governance subcommittee, And I'm hopeful to hear some of the recommendations that would be coming forward to our board to really thoroughly evaluate that, that really get at those particular questions.
Are those options, though, I mean, I you know, don't know what's going on in those meetings, are those options that are honestly being talked about? Because it would seem like we either move as we go ahead as we are and sort of nibble at the little technical differences and try and patch those, or we talk about truly a regional solution. Are we talking about both those things?
Mr. Mayor, we are. The governance subcommittee of the joint strategic planning session absolutely is. And the reports I've gotten back is there's been just tremendous progress being made in terms of a real cooperative effort to really look at this particular issue. And by the way, despite that effort moving forward, I don't want to underestimate that even prior to that, there's been a tremendous amount of cross-communication, collaboration anyway that's been going on. It's just that once we, at that January 26th meeting where that joint resolution was adopted, it solidified a lot of prior efforts that had already been occurring, like sharing a joint capital plan, to making sure that we aren't either disproportionately, maybe inappropriately, having too much redundancy on that that really should be addressed from a systems standpoint and a cost standpoint.
I'm glad to hear. I mean, because for the little bit I hear is that living in the past, we had this divorce, as Councilman Cowan says, and we've never moved past that. And it seems like what you're saying is that that's not the case, that for whatever happened, and I wasn't around when that happened and don't really want to go back because it's irrelevant to today. What's relevant is what are we going to do tomorrow? It appears as though a lot of progress is made, and if you and Charlie Myers are talking, you're neither Mesa, you're neither Phoenix, and all too often this is referred to as the Mesa system and the Phoenix system, and neither one of those are correct. They're both regional systems,
right,
or sub-regional, I guess, since they don't cover the entire region. It's good to know that people are talking, and would you say that dwelling on the past is maybe a little bit outdated, and maybe we are moving toward some kind of joint collaboration, setting the stage for some kind of regional solution, whatever it might be? You
Mr.
feel confident
Mayor,
with that?
I do, Mr. Mayor. However, it's always a good exercise to look at the past,
well,
make
yeah,
sure we're learning
learn
from the
it.
Past, as we all know, with whatever we're working on. So there's always a step forward with an eye to the past to make sure, you know, are we examining where we've been to make sure that those similar strategies or attempts to try to fix something is not redone so that we can do a better job in moving the whole region forward. So I think that was a great summary of really where we're at with the
Vice
report.
Excuse me, so I'm a little confused. I hear, hey, we've all been working together, we're all moving in the right direction, but we are having this meeting for a reason, and it came through public safety. And unless some wonderful communication's been going on in the last month and a half or so, things aren't all good. And so I'm kind of confused to what I'm hearing from you and the feedback we've been getting on the two regional systems. I am optimistic and positive that we're moving in the right direction. I do appreciate your service. You know, this is you're not being paid to do this. It's part of additional services that you provide through the town of Queen Creek. But I just don't want people to be left with the, hey, we're all working together, we're all moving the right direction, or we wouldn't be here right now, you know, struggling through some of this. Big issues to get solved. You know, you've had kind of an unprecedented move by a public safety committee to try and force the issue and to get things out there. So, you know, staying on the positive in the nice, happy place. I don't know, have we, unless something's happened in 6 weeks, some great communications, I think we still have some big problems. So what would you say?
Yeah, Mr. Mayor, Mr. Vice Mayor, I certainly don't want to send the message that everything is absolutely perfect and the lines of communication are completely unobstructed. That's not the case. And frankly, whatever the future pretends, I don't know that we ever really get there just because of the nature of who we are as humans. But the area of continuous improvement that I think is really the subject of a lot of the conversation that's going on today is who at the stakeholder level should be involved now with respect to arriving at some better solutions for the future. For example, the user group slide that I went over. You know, it was our expectation, at least 5 years ago when I came on board, our own committee structure, that the operational subcommittees, we had the right people in place that were communicating at all levels in their respective departments and organizations. And for the most part, I think that was happening, but it may not have been happening at the frequency or the level of communication to make sure it was coming back and going up to the board level as it really should have been. So, and the RWC had the same series of issues, and they got a much more elaborate committee structure that exists, but they're just now forming their own real user group as well, by the way. So I just, when I share the comments about continuous improvement and then this collaboration communication, it's in that particular context as we move forward. Having more stakeholders at the table to help move forward, I think, is a good thing. I think we're heading in that right direction.
Okay. Randy, you want to speed through the technical stuff?
I would be happy to. Our performance measures, we measure right now a couple of things, the availability of the system. In other words, the probability that when somebody pushes the button, the system is there to respond to them. And the other thing is they've got to have a channel to be able to talk on. We measure those things now. And I've got a chart coming up in just a minute. What it's a little more difficult to do that we don't have real good tools to do now has to do with actual coverage. Are we in a spot where there's either a lack of coverage or some interference that inhibits that? That's one of our next things to work on in that regard. As far as our availability of the system and meeting our goal, as you can see, we've done very good. The blip there that you see in December was actually just one out of the 9 radio sites that cover here in the floor of the valley, and it was a total, it was 2 short events that totaled up for 61 seconds. So we set the bar very high, obviously, to make sure that it's available when our users need it to be. And with that, are there any additional questions?
Councilor Summers.
Just a brief one to clarify. How does this system, do we anticipate the system is going to interact with what the federal government's putting together with SafeCom and FirstNet? I know FirstNet is data, but SafeCom and FirstNet are doing some considerable work in the arena of both voice and data communications. So how are we going to be able to scale this?
I think the current thinking, Mayor and Councilmember Summers, the current thinking is that certainly for the foreseeable future, the voice radio systems like the one that I've been talking about this morning that we currently operate is going to complement what's being done in the broadband arena. As far as the point in time where what's being done in broadband would replace what's being done on the current voice radio networks, I don't think anybody has a clear idea of when that'll be. And obviously one of the things that needs to happen is the build out of the broadband network to even start talking, having those discussions.
So we don't know. But we, at least at the broadband, I think we'll be able to integrate that with it. That's parallel but a bit separate of a track.
Yes, and they're very complementary systems, in fact, in that regard.
Well, until the committee takes a hold of it. Okay.
All right. Any further questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Mayor, and I appreciate you adjusting your schedule for me.
Oh, no. Thank you for coming. We appreciate it. Well, this is information. Well, it's information. Brian, and I know that the Public Safety Committee asked that you be given a chance to say a couple things if you'd like. Brian Jeffries.
Good morning, Mayor and Council. Thank you for having me and giving me some time to speak. In just a moment, I will be joined by one of my colleagues. For the record, I'm Brian Jeffries, President of the United Mesa Firefighters Association, Captain for the Mesa Fire Department. Joining me here in just a moment is Captain Randy Budd, a close colleague of mine who spent 3.5 years working at Station 203 on West University and is now a captain at Station 218 at Alma School on 8th Street. And so for the past, 7, 8 years, Randy has worked directly in this system and uses these radios every single day, every single shift. Wouldn't you say that's accurate?
On a regular basis, I'm very familiar with the system.
Mayor and Council, first of all, it's very regrettable that you guys have to contemplate this issue because it is highly complicated, and to break it down into manageable parts in this forum is quite challenging. Before I start my presentation, do you have it? Okay. Do you have it up? Or? Before I start my presentation, let me help you a little bit with some analogies that'll help get your head around and break this down really simply. This radio right here, whether it's one radio, before we had two. We had one was a cell phone and one was a walkie-talkie. That's really the difference. Cell phones operate off of towers and digital technology, thank you, and walkie-talkies talk to each other directly. What the Phoenix or RWC system, 30 agencies decided, was that they are not willing to rely just on cell phones for their firefighter safety on calls. So they were going to, in the hazard zone, still stick with walkie-talkies. That's as simple as it gets. So what we've done now with these radios, which is an improvement, most definitely, is taken walkie-talkies and cell phones and put them together in one place. So if that helps you get your head around that one thing. But it's so much more complicated than just that. One of the analogies that I use in looking at what this really means is that imagine for a moment, it's so fitting that we had light rail before this, because imagine for a moment you've got the Seattle monorail that Mesa has decided to go with. And in Tempe, they've decided to go with the Metro model underground. And in Phoenix, they decided to go with a BART above ground level. What we're trying to do is match all those systems together in a regional system, okay, with different governances, by the way. What this radio did is it said, okay, we've got a lot of stuff to cover here to try to make a monorail, an underground, and a ground level match together. But what we are going to do is you're not going to need three tickets anymore as you go across the valley. You have one ticket, it'll get you all the way across. Although all the systems are different, you now have one ticket. So there's my little analogies for you, just to help you just break this down and make it quite simple. So let's talk about our view of kind of where things are today. This really, let me go back for a second. I'm going to break this down in a little bit of history because I think it's important. What our concerns are, some really positive stuff because I think we're at a really unique opportunity now to make all this better and go away for you all, as well as our vision. So if you read this briefly, and I'm sure you already have in the packet, it talks about the serious, significant issues that happened on 9/11 and the findings of the inability for folks to talk to one another. And what's interesting is a couple weeks ago, a dear friend of mine was out here. He just retired from Orange County Fire. And he was one of the original Orange County firefighters when all the communities came together, much like we all came together here in the Valley. And he was the incident commander on some of the massive wildfires they had in California. And what he said, well, what have you been up to, Brian? We went to a spring training game together, and we got hailed on, unfortunately. But when we were talking, he said, what have you been up to? And I told him about this radio issue that we're having a great challenge with. And he broke into a story, a pretty emotional story, about when he was part of the incident command team that watched all those houses burn. And one of the biggest challenges they had is they couldn't talk to each other, all those agencies coming in to work together. So it's important that we address this and we address it soon. So we know that the valleys come together geographically. You've already talked about that. The rural metro radio infrastructure that emanated from Scottsdale, pretty much gone, not an issue for us anymore. Town of Queen Creek, many others that used to use them. So there's really just Topaz and RWC that's left. And what has emanated as well is our automatic aid system, which is the best system in the planet as far as I'm concerned. And we operate like One Valley Fire Department. We operate off of Volume 2, which is our SOP, our Standard Operating Procedures, that you'll find on every computer and every desk from Surprise to Apache Junction. This is the last but by far the most important piece of bringing that system together, and that is our radio, and inclusive of that is our dispatch system. And I'm telling you this, and I'm telling you, I've come before this body many times, but this is the most important presentation I'm going to ever do for you, because the only reason I'm here is for firefighter safety. That is the only, and our citizen safety. This issue profoundly affects our safety, period.
Well,
much has been said about the history that I know the mayor doesn't want to live through, but I think it's important we touch on it for just a moment. And
I didn't say I didn't want to live through it. I don't want to dwell on it.
When we dwell on it,
we forget what the solution to the problem is.
Correct. But I think what is important is that, you know, the genesis of Topaz happened because folks that were sitting at the table had a difficult time trying to come together. I believe one of the reasons for that, that I don't know if has been discussed, in the past when a town, let's say like Goodyear or Avondale, they probably had a volunteer fire department many, many years ago, and they started to grow, and they probably had somewhere in City Hall a little dispatch where somebody would call in and they'd call for police and fire, and they had a very old dispatch and radio system that was probably held together in baling wire and duct tape. And as they started to grow, Phoenix built a regional system. They said, hey, if you give us your bandwidth, we'll come in and we'll give you a much more modern system and you just buy into ours. And they would go, oh, thank God, here. Yeah, we got to get rid of this old contraption. Let's get on your system. That's a great. And that's how all those little communities all came into the 30-community RWC. And I think, and I don't know this for certain, but I think Phoenix inappropriately treated Mesa as though it was that type of situation. And it wasn't. We had our own very robust system that we had built for many, many years. So I think that's where that whole thing kind of went awry. So I thought it was important to bring that up. Nonetheless, it didn't work out so well, and the system went two separate routes, and that is why we are here today. We warned, and Councilman Kavanaugh, you'll recall this, we mentioned back then that this is going to be a problem. We were very concerned because no matter what you do, when two divorced people are trying to raise their kids, it doesn't work as well as when they're in the same household. And that is as simple as I can get when we talk about, the RWC and TRWC, well, they're having meetings and they're forming joint resolutions. And they're trying, just like a divorced couple tries to help their kids get through school together as best they can, but it's not the same. Well, we have tried many means internally to get a lot of these things fixed. We have asked to put user groups together, and that wouldn't happen until recently. With respect to John Cross, I think he really believed what he said, and that there was a lot of communication going back and forth from guys like Randy in the field to the folks making the decision, but it was a one-way communication. We were, frankly, sold a bill of goods. This is the next best thing. This is what we're going to do. This is why we're doing it. Those guys in Phoenix don't know what they're talking about. Those other 30 agencies don't know what they're talking about. This is the latest, greatest thing, and this is what we need to do. Well, what we've discovered is that this has become an unsafe situation for us. Several data-driven reports have proven what I'm saying. The Buford and Goff report, as well as the FEMA report that I provided for you guys, talks about the challenges of using a cell phone type system in the hazard zone. So we've been concerned that Topaz has not, they just mentioned today they're forming a strategic plan. That's several years in the making. They're still just forming a strategic plan. And we think that the results of this have really compromised our safety. That we have ended up with what, according to the FEMA report, is the most dangerous system that we can use in the hazard zone. And part of the challenge is that we've uncoupled that 800 megahertz system from the Phoenix system. You heard today that they're going to build a tower on Shaw Butte. Well, if we could couple our 800 megahertz systems together, we wouldn't have to do that. We could use their tower that they have in Phoenix, and they can use our towers out here in Mesa. So I'm not going to get into all of these other pieces here. They've already been mentioned, and you've had a pretty good overview on some of them. But the bottom line is that they're just now reacting to the fact that gentlemen like Randy and others who've had to use this system had no say whatsoever, and nobody's even asked them, how's this working for you? We've got this massive responsibility for something that profoundly affects you. What do you think? How's it working? The big issue is the confusion problem. Excuse me here. That is really the challenge, because on a med call in Mesa, you're on one megahertz system, 800 megahertz system. Across the other side of the border, you're using another 800 megahertz system. If you're in the hazard zone in Mesa, you're using 800 megahertz. If you're in the hazard zone in Tempe or Chandler, you're using VHF. Yes, you've got a radio that'll go back between all of those, but each of them is different. And that's the real challenge. And it gets even worse. Randy does this every day. If Randy takes a day off and I work for him tomorrow, I've got to go, okay, I might go on a call in 10 minutes here. I've got to get reacquainted with this because I'm not using it on the east side. That's a major problem. So I know this sounds a little concerning and whatnot, and I don't want it to be that way, because there's really good news here. There are tremendous opportunities to make all this, to fix all this, and make some of these headaches for you all go away. I mentioned the analogy earlier. I'm somewhat of an urban policy wonk, like I know you guys are a little bit too, and I follow some people, and there's a gentleman named Ray Bradbury. He's out of Los Angeles, and he recently passed away. He was always pounding his fist on the table for many years because he believed that the LA light rail LRT system that they have needed to evolve to a monorail system. He felt it was cheaper, much easier to develop. It didn't impact local businesses, much like you guys were discussing today, because you'd prefab the monorail, then you'd come and you'd install it, and then it would have less impact and less challenges for the traffic, et cetera. He also, and some of you might recall, when we were developing the light rail system, the RTA talked about that. That was actually one of the options. It didn't come to fruition, but at the end of the day, Ray Bradbury never realized his dream, because most of the establishment said, "We love what you've got to say, Ray, but we're too indoctrinated in our light rail system now. It'd be too much to convert and to transition all this. It would be too much expense." For where we are today with our Topaz governance system, as well as the infrastructure that we're utilizing, to bring these things together is not some enormous feat to accomplish. It won't happen overnight. If we work in that direction, it's going to take time, it's going to take collaboration, and it will probably take a little bit of money. But I haven't got exact figures, but it's not a lot of money, and it's not a lot of effort. But where it has to begin from our point of view is that the fine people like John Cross and the others that are members of the TRWC have got to immediately take what they're doing finally at this committee level and blow that up into a full-blown amalgamation level. They need to come back together. To us, that is the only solution, because in just 5 short years, by them being separate, look at how dramatic a problem has been created. Had they never separated, had we given it a more of a college try and kept it together, this never would have occurred. That I can guarantee you. And so if we can get them back together, it's not a flip of the switch. It doesn't get solved overnight. But what we can be sure to is the couples in the household together making the decisions together. And so long after all of our tenures, they're doing these things strategically, making financial decisions strategically, and they're doing it the same, because all guys like Randy are asking for is that it's the same and it's predictable and it's user-friendly. Because when the you-know-what hits the fan, and as Dan Stubbs mentioned earlier, you've got nanoseconds to make decisions. You can't be trying to remember which side of Price Road you're on. And if this costs $250,000 or $500,000 or $1 million, these are the only kind of dollars we're talking about to fix this. But what a dead firefighter costs is far more important to me. So I'm going to wrap this up and say that the good news is that this can be fixed very easily. Phoenix, and why this opportunity is so good right now, Phoenix kind of knows that this got a little screwed up too. There's different players in the room. They just went through this exact process with the city of Scottsdale. Scottsdale left that very satisfied. They thought it went well. They had a lot of their own infrastructure that they had to negotiate on how that would be controlled and financed and everything else. In addition, Phoenix has gone on 800 megahertz on 80% of the calls they go on, like us, mostly medical calls and other major or minor emergencies. And they've shown a willingness to work together because they got in a car and drove and met with Chris in his office to talk about this. Charlie Meyer wanted to do this. Ed Zerker wants to do this. I can tell you with all the phone calls I'm receiving from people, IT people in Phoenix, IT people in Scottsdale, throughout the Valley, they are dying for this to happen because they know how unbelievably important it is. Governance matters, and I've already mentioned that. So what do we want? What's our vision? One seamless Valley-wide user-friendly radio system. And I'll be back here again soon to talk about one seamless Valley-wide radio dispatch system. It's a volume two approach, as I mentioned, and from surprise to AJ, it'll be the same. Our wants and needs are that the divorce gets reconciled immediately. People put their egos and put their other issues aside and work on who is the most important person in this equation, and that is people like the guy sitting next to me. And treat this like light rail. We don't want to have different a monorail and a metro and a BART in one region. It doesn't make any sense whatsoever. We do have a resolution. I've given it all to you, and I'm hoping that you will support that resolution or some similar form of direction to try to get us moving where we need to be. And I'll end this with I'd like to turn it over to Randy for just a moment. Because people have asked me, well, Brian, okay, you've mentioned all these things about the governance and these problems, but, you know, have you any stories or situations that you can tell us about? And that's why I brought Randy today, so I'm going to turn it over to him.
Good morning. I'm Randy Bott. I've been a captain for about 8 years on the west side, so I'm very familiar with the challenges as a company officer communicating within this system. I kind of look at this as not a divorce, but a separation. I think maybe if everybody was able to get back together, it would be safer, especially in this area that I work in, for my firefighters and myself. When I show up in the morning and I have my regular crew, my crew has been very versed into going into Tempe and switching the way the radio communication takes place. It's challenging. We have multiple radios. We're using a system that we get dispatched on when we go across the border, where we go from an 800 system into a VHF system. Our VHF system, from what I understand on that part of the border, isn't as robust as it used to be. So when I turn the radio head on in the cockpit, because it's like flying an aircraft now, because I got to go from radio head to another radio head inside the cab, figure out where we're going. I have to make sure my firefighters realize we're going into Tempe. And when we're doing that, the first thing I'm listening to, besides getting the CAD information, which is a little delayed because it's going through two communication systems, is listening to what's going on the fire ground in the hot zone. Because I want to know what's going to happen. I want my firefighters to know what they're going into for safety reasons. Well, the system isn't broadcasting right away into our truck radio. So I keep up refreshing the CAD, the computer-aided dispatch system, so that I can get that information as the dispatch is upgrading it, sending it to Mesa, and then to our computer. That's a challenge, because the more information we know, the better off we're going to be to assist and know what our assignment's going to be when we get there. So that system's not as linked as good as it probably could be. And that's right on the west side of town. That's with my regular crew. If I get a crew or a callback or an overtime or someone that's coming in that's not part of my crew from station 19, station on the east side of town, they're not used to going to a VHF system. They're used to this digital system where they have to key the mic, wait for the blank, and then communicate. It works differently. The way you hold it in a structure fire next to your mask is different. They don't operate the same. Getting proficient at that in a hot zone isn't the same. So those are challenges. So in the morning when someone comes in, I make sure I introduce them to both radio systems, let them know my expectations, because my responsibility as a company officer is their safety and that they go home the next day. Excuse me. Brian asked me, we were just talking the other day on the phone because I had a question for him, and he said, hey, by the way, have you had any challenges with the 800 system and the VHF system where you work? And I said, I've had a few of them, but one stands out more than the other. So I'd like to make this brief and share a little incident that I had. And I'm not sure why it happened, but I'll let me tell you. We were doing the pool fence walk one Saturday in April a few years ago, looking for homes around the Dobson Mesa area that needed a pool fence for security reasons. We had pool fence companies donating fences to people in that area. So we were walking around that area looking for a yard that needed a pool fence that they couldn't afford to do it. Well, at the time we got dispatched, it was at near the area of Dobson in Maine. So we were about 45 seconds drive from that area. It was on San Jose, the 100 North block of San Jose. Well, I looked up and I go, wow, we got a working fire. So initially got put out as a working fire. We upgraded it, and we were there within about 2 minutes. I assumed command because that's what the first engine company does on a working fire, and it was obviously going to be a hot zone, immediately danger to life and hazard. We had a fourplex apartment complex that had heavy fire and smoke showing from the second story. We established a water supply, pulled a long hose line, and I went interior. My firefighters did everything appropriate. They had their 800 radios on, turned on the right channel, and we went in, and we had heavy smoke and fire blowing out the porch door, and we went in. And, you know, it's a little pucker factor when you're doing that. You're under a little bit of stress, but that's what we get paid for. So we go in. We're fighting the fire. I'm giving them a report. The chief from Tempe, Chief Bailey, assumes command because I'm a mobile command at this time, and it's hard to direct everybody when you're working inside with your crew. He assumes command. I hear that, and then I don't hear much traffic. I can hear him talking, and then I hear him calling me inside. And this is hot. We're down low. We're fighting fire, and we're looking for any rescue because that's our job. We're looking for victims, looking for any salvageable life, and this is a pretty significant fire. I hear him talking to me, and I got two firefighters in there. One's a recruit, and they're fairly new, or a rookie, and my other firefighter's pretty seasoned. And I go, I'm trying to talk back. I can't talk back to the command. Well, command gets very upset, if you ever listen to a structure fire, when the interior captain isn't given a report back, because he wants to make sure we're doing okay, and he can only see from the outside. He doesn't know what's going on from the inside. So when we don't talk back, he thinks there's something wrong with us. I'm fine. I'm in there. It's hot. We're working the fire. And I'm like, well, maybe my radio's bad. So I have the one radio in one hand, have to put my equipment down, grab the other firefighter's radio, and try to do the same thing. Interior to command, he doesn't hear me. Hit the bonk on the button, can't hear me. So I'm like, well, I got two radios. Put the other one in my pocket, have the other one in my hand, and grab the third radio. Try to do the same thing, nothing. So I get out, my two firefighters are still fighting fire, trying to progress in to get a primary all clear, and I step out on the porch, and I wave to the other captains that are outside doing work and saying, hey, I'm okay, and I wish I would have had a bugle because I could have communicated better, or a walkie-talkie like Brian said, because I got a cell phone, and obviously for some reason, I'm not able to communicate with them. We're okay, but command can't see us, they're not at a vantage point where they can see me waving, and nobody can see me on the porch. So I'm doing another minute out there, making sure my firefighter's okay, and then I'm trying to get someone. Finally, someone notices, but they're ready to send emergency traffic in, and everybody's worried about the interior crew on engine 218, why they're not talking back to command. Well, I'm doing my job because I take it serious. I just had the limitations with the radio that I had at that day, able to communicate with command. We ended up going up from offensive to defensive right at that point. And I don't know if I would have been able to communicate with command at that time. I felt like I was still safe inside. I still wanted to get a primary all clear. The fire was spreading from that building to the next adjacent fourplex, and it actually did spread. We pulled out, went from offensive, where we're fighting the fire, to a defensive strategy. They regrouped, made sure we were okay, and then we went back in and fought fire on the other side of the building. But that one apartment was lost, and I don't know if that would have changed the commander's strategy, but I'm sure it had an effect on them. And the other thing that worried me more than that was, if I had emergency traffic and I needed to communicate with command, or I had something I needed to tell them, I was unable to do it without screaming out on the porch window, which isn't the optimal way of doing things. I've had other challenges, and sometimes they're human error, and then sometimes they're because of technology.
And Randy, if you could, and thank you. Did you ever? What was the cause for the Did you ever determine the cause for the inability?
I never found out what the cause was. Sometimes, Mayor, the radio will get wet. you know, and that, no matter what it is, if it gets too wet, you have a communication problem. So I've had that issue in the past, and some of the newer radios are supposed to be better at staying dry in a wet environment because we go in with a hose. Yeah. There's a lot of water being produced. So typically when I have that challenge, I grab another radio from the other firefighter because theirs are usually deep in their pocket because their hands are full with tools and hose lines. They don't get as wet as mine does. As my, it's usually in my hand or I have a lapel mic. So I grab the other radio. So I have to believe somewhere along the line I wasn't hitting the tower from the vantage point that I was at.
Okay, hitting the tower. So the incident commander, even though he was 10P, was on the 800?
He was on the 800. And they have to go from the VHF to the 800 when they come to Mason.
Let me ask this, and I'm just trying to understand, because I'm still trying to figure out what these new radios will do for us. And I know they're not the ultimate solution, so yeah. I get it, and we'll get back to that. How is it different if we're in these dual band and you have the ability to go VHF in the entire...
In my point of view as a user and as one of the children of the divorce, is it's nice because I don't have to carry two radios, but I still have to use two radios that work completely different. One works as a digital 800, and in Mesa, we use it 24/7, whether we're in a hot zone or we're on a med call. When we go to Tempe or we go to Scottsdale, we go to Chandler or Phoenix, when we go in a hot zone, we go to the VHF radio, which is a walkie-talkie and can be repeated through a tower.
So I can understand, is part of your desire that Topaz adopt VHF and go to VHF for a hot zone?
My desire would be to operate in the safest environment that I can and that we all operate in the same rules. And
but what I'm
by
hearing
the same
though, that you believe in a hot zone, that would be VHF.
Yeah, because if I need help and the tower goes down or we have a disaster and they lose those towers, then I can still talk to command.
Okay.
And yes, Mayor, I would echo that. And you know, based on the research we've done, that's exactly what is still being recommended by all the major fire organizations in the nation. The International Association of Fire Chiefs, the International Association of Firefighters, and FEMA are all saying that, you know, and this is important. This differs a lot from what the police experience. Police can use digital band radios pretty easily because they don't operate in inclement conditions like we do. The getting wet and using talking through a mask, those are some of the major challenges we have. And you're
so one of the things you would like the Topaz group to look at is, hey, listen, as you're hopefully working towards some regional solution, at least we need to seriously consider VHF. Is that
without question? And yes, that is absolutely part of the answer.
Now that we have dual band radios, we could, for example, in Mesa, we could do that. I don't know what our other partners would like, but in Mesa, we could do that now because we
absolutely
have a dual
band radio. Already have a VHS system in place. I don't know the condition of it. I'm told somewhat anecdotally that it would take a minimal expense to get that back up.
So that's one thing you'd like them to consider.
Yeah. And one of the reasons Randy mentioned that's really important is that that system needs to be up and tied into the Phoenix system, because as the problem is if you're trying to use VHS, as he's traveling to Tempe and wants to be able to hear what's going on in the hot zone prior to his arrival, the system's not robust enough to let him hear until he's almost within that hazard.
Is that a repeat? Is that a tower? That,
yeah, the repeaters, from what I understand, since we went to this 800, which on EMS calls and other calls, it's phenomenal. But when you're doing and going from Mesa on that border, the VHF repeater, I can only hear radio to radio a lot of times when I'm going into Tempe. So unless I'm a mile and a half away from the incident, I'm not hearing what's going on. So I'm going in blind except for what's on the computer.
And my understanding is that that's one reason why VHF, why Phoenix is moving and others are moving to 800 on a system-wide, because VHF does have a limited distance.
Right.
And they're more prone to incidents because it can stay within that mile or so.
You nailed it, Mayor. That's exactly right. 800 megahertz systems, Mike, cell phones are designed, I mean, you can call me from D.C., you know what I mean, to cover a large area. But there's, you know, you drop calls all the time. That's why they're not safe in the hazard zone.
Okay. Vice Mayor?
Well, and I appreciate the presentation. The irony, you know, it keeps hitting me is, okay, so and I hear our Mary's always about, hey, let's solve these issues. So for years now, we've been hearing from the end user, at least there's been this concern. We have these concerns, portables, hardware, VHF. So suddenly, or now we're at this last 6 weeks, we've had to rise to the city council level to try and fix this thing. And I mentioned in our public safety committee, there seems like an autocratic approach to how we're managing this. We have the potential for millions of dollars in cost. some of these things could have been solved really easy, really early, a couple of years ago. And I don't mean to go on a little rant here, but big taxpayer dollars, if we just get people communicating, this governance thing can be worked out, these hardware things. You know, we talk about these radios like they're in place. They're not in place now. There's been a scramble to get these things in the last little while and say, hey, here's the hardware, the problem's fixed, and you guys are saying it's bigger than that. So, Mayor, dear Mayor, we have got to fix how this governance is from how the communications are going on, because they are not happening, and it shouldn't be at a council level. It should have been solved a long time ago.
Well, I absolutely agree with you. Now, what I'm trying to do is I still don't understand what – I mean, I understand on the bigger picture, but I want to get down to what the real issue is, and that's why when we're talking governance, there's two issues going on here. One is a hot zone communication, and what I'm hearing from you is, hey, regardless of what happens to us, we would like – VHF in hot zones because it's a superior system. The second thing is, and while I don't like to dwell on history, I understand why we've had thing. Remember, this divorce was not a mutual divorce. Somebody had an affair, okay? And the reason I say that is that when somebody is disloyal, there's an open wound, and that open wound festers. Now, at some point in time, you just got to get over it and get on with life. But I don't think it's as easy as say, oh, gee, we just decided to leave. The fact of the matter is we got kicked out. Okay, we were asked to leave. I've seen the letter. It was not a nice letter. Okay, now I'm not going to hold that. I wasn't here. Most people around here, a lot of people around here weren't here. None on this council, I believe. Well, maybe Scott was when it happened. Maybe it happened before you came on. But the fact is that this was a separation that was not. That was not mutual, it was unilateral. That shouldn't stand in the way of us solving a problem now. But I can understand why we didn't just a year after or 2 years after, why we started going our own way. And that's created, in my mind, the problem we have now is because that was such an acrimonious split that people started moving their own way. Now, it would have been nice if everyone would have stayed really close so that any future joining would have been a lot easier. What I'd like to see is I'd like to look at a regional solution, because I think because of the way the divorce happened, the first two options I don't think will ever happen. For what it is, I don't think I seriously doubt. I don't know why, but tell me if I'm wrong. I don't think RWCD is going to merge into Topaz. You think that's going to happen? No. And I think that there's enough bad feelings that Topaz and we're in a different world now. Merging into RDBC, it's still viewed as a Phoenix system, and that creates some problems. I think there's real potential with a regional system, and I would love to see serious discussion on both sides if what you're saying is correct, and I hope it is, because we've done so much on a regional level over the last 5 years because of the different players, because of the advances we've made in things like transit. I mean, the fact that we are now talking, and Phoenix is talking about combining bus and rail, and we've combined the leadership at least. That's a huge regional success. It seems like we could take the same approach on this situation and talk seriously about how do we merge into a regional, true regional governance like we do on many other things like transit, like MAG, like other things, and look for real solutions. That's one issue. The other one is do we really or should we really actively pursue this VHF capability? We now have it. My understanding is every truck, if it's not been retrofitted yet, will be retrofitted with a dual-band radio, VHF N800. Every firefighter in Mesa will have one of these dual-band radios, whether you're on the border or not on the border. We should be able to train them on the easy operation of that radio. And so maybe there's an issue we can play within Mesa. Maybe it's not a Topaz issue. Maybe it is. About the VHF as far as hot zone communications. To me, that's somewhat of a separate, although I know it at the end of the day, they all come together. But that it appears that that's somewhat of a separate issue. Am I missing something? Because, Brian, I agree with you. It seems complicated, but to me, I remember when I was in home building. We used to get in these meetings, and we're talking about the problems with the sewer system and the water system and all these comments. I said, guys, it comes down to this. When I walk into my kitchen and turn the faucet, do I get water? It really is simple. And to me, it seems like, Ray, when you go over and you click that button, can you talk to somebody? And to me, it's really simple. And I think one of the problems here is that we get lost in the complications and forget that at the end of the day, we only want a firefighter to be able to push a button and talk to somebody important so they can either get in or get out. That seems like a real simple objective to get to. And how we get there, I don't really care. I would seem to care that we be able to do that. Am I missing something?
You're spot on, Mayor. And the only thing I would caution is that I believe the elephant in the room is that a few select people were involved in this, and it became about power and control, not about the customer. Because you're right. The customer is who matters. They got to be able to push that button, and they got to be able to get the water.
Welcome to our world. I mean, well, exactly. We deal with that every day, but we seem to get over it. So
hire a marriage counselor, because I absolutely believe the marriage has to happen, because otherwise you're putting Band-Aids on it. Well, what if we just had VHF over here?
I
20 years from now, new firefighters today should be operating on one single system. It's not going to happen tomorrow, but that's the kind of vision we have to have. One light rail, one
so
radio system.
So would you, I mean, which what solution do you support as far as regional? The one that I described with a regional type thing, is that your, if you had a Christmas list, is that your wish list, or how would you define
it? It's three parts. Your level, one regional governance, period. The chief, the executive level, department director level, is all the chiefs decide that we're going to have one regional operating approach. Our standard operating procedures will all be the same on how we do radios. At Randy's level, we're going to do lots of training together as a region to make sure we're all doing it the same and we're doing it correctly.
So if I'm hearing you and listening to what, and I'm sorry Mr. Cross had to leave because he had another thing, but as he described, there is already a group. There's already two working groups. Now, whether they're efficient, effective, and we can go back and forth, one of them has been in existence for quite a while. It certainly predates what happened at Public Safety. The other one may have come about, and if it did, great. You know, I think Kevin's, they heard the cry, and they put together a users group. So if this council basically gave direction, or really, since it's already happening, maybe some encouragement to get serious about those discussions, and maybe we said, hey, come back and report to us, because we'd really like you to pursue, rather than meet together and nibble around the edges, maybe go to the meat of the matter. Now, I'd also like to see some real action from the other side. This was a one-way split. It can't be a one-way rejoining.
Well, them getting in the car and driving to Chris's office, I think, is a heck of a great indicator.
I would hope so. Because I hear from others who are part of that 30 thing that they didn't join because they really wanted to come together. It was just sort of the big guy ate them up. They had no other choice. So there's a lot of complexities in the politics that go on here. If we can get over that, if we can give encouragement to our Topaz group, which remember, this is not a Mesa system. It is a regional system. We have partners. And to actively discuss the potential of creating or moving ahead with perhaps a regional system that encompasses the entire region, and as a sidebar, maybe looking at increasing capabilities, including a VHF hot zone type capabilities, is that an encouragement that we could give, or how do you want to phase that? Because
I'm not asking you for that; I'm begging you for that, because it's that critical. And I would love it if you picked up the phone and called Mayor Stanton and said, could you have a discussion with Mr. Cavazos and motivate him to also...
Well, I will, believe me, because I will tell you, I have not. There's been not a single mayor throughout this valley that's discussed this issue with me.
I know. So that's the challenge, is we need political leadership.
And I get together with him 4, 5, 6 times a month, and I can tell you that this has never been an issue.
The managers have all held this. That's the problem.
So it has not risen, other than where we're talking today, I'm not aware that it's risen to this level in any other city, and it probably needs to get that kind of things. We can certainly put out the branch, but unless it gets beyond the management level into the elected official level,
we always already have resolutions that have been drafted and proposed to the city of Chandler, the city of Tempe, as well as we're bringing one to the city of Scottsdale. They've already reviewed a similar resolution that I've given you, and we're already getting a lot of nods that they're on board. So it is going to that level.
Okay. Well, I'm not aware of it. But I can see, you know, we have the presentation. We have the city manager sitting right here, although Chris isn't on the Topaz. Our staff certainly is represented on that. We can say what Mesa wants, and we can put in our two bits as to what that group. If a group already exists on both levels, it would seem like we just need to nudge them toward the solution if there really is a problem. I first of all want to get detail as to what the real problem is, because I hear a lot of clutter. And I want to know, when our firefighters go across boundaries or when they're working either, can they easily flip a switch, and can they push a button, can they talk to each other?
As usual, you got to the heart of the matter, as you always do, and that is exactly what we're looking for.
And any other discussion beyond that, to me, is clutter. I don't
agree.
I mean, I'm a pilot, and I tell you, I know how to switch between frequencies and controllers all the time. So I'm familiar with it. And when you got the protocol down, it's real easy. But when you're flying in clouds in the middle of turbulence, sometimes hitting that is tough, and I've been lost. I know what it's like. I haven't been in a fire, but not real fun to be in a cloud and not know which way is up or down and not be able to talk to anybody on the ground. Not fun. So there's a little bit of terror involved in that, too, because you don't know where the mountain is in front of you. So I get the feeling of when you're – and there's so much turbulence you can't hit the radio. So I sort of feel your pain in a much different venue. I just want to talk to somebody, so I know what you're talking about. So, Vice Mayor?
So direction, would that be, hey, let's fix it, let's get everybody happy, let's meet with those other cities, let's get on the right track to do it? Is that the direction?
I would like the direction, and then perhaps come back in, 2 months or so, report back from Topaz to this council to see what has happened. Mr. Brady, what...
Yeah, it's interesting sitting here being quoted about things that no one else is admitting to. From the beginning, this city manager has always encouraged a regional solution. Yeah. Matter of fact, I proposed that to Tempe and Phoenix, that we needed to behave just like we do at MAG and many other places. So that would be if that's the recommendation of the council, we'd be glad to share that with Topaz. I'll be glad to endorse that with Phoenix and the other city managers. That
and I'll be more than happy to, on my level, to talk to the various mayors and to bring it up as a joint issue and push it from that side. To have the serious discussions, not just nibbling around. And then report back within the next quarter and to see how those.
Yeah, that engagement is happening between Topaz and RGCD. I will encourage that at the level I can, but that specific conversation, I'll communicate that to Chairman Cross and have him maybe come back and report back.
That okay?
At some point in the future.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Brady. That's very encouraging, and I appreciate your comments as well, Mr. Mayor, and we'll keep communicating about it because it's really about communications.
Well, and once again, I feel much more confident because this, hopefully the story that Randy said and having to carry the radios, I grant that you consider these Band-Aids, but to me these are significant Band-Aids, that you got one radio, a new radio, a dual-band radio, which I do believe, from what they told us, is much more water resistant, shock resistant. It's the state of the art, and we're retrofitting our trucks too to make sure that they can communicate cross borders. I'm assuming our training will follow with our firefighters, so they don't have to be retrained when they rotate to a station. That they'll all have that radio and all know how to use it, and we'll go from there. Okay.
Very good,
Councilmember Summers.
Mayor, and Mr. Brady, could we revisit this after budget? Discussions are over. I know you've said 2 months, but just
have it.
Oh, yeah.
That'll give us some.
Yeah, we'll bring that back within the next quarter.
June, July. Yeah, that'll
for sure.
That'll give you some time to get the meetings done. And we okay.
I'll mention that to Mr. Cross.
Thank you.
You've indulged us with a lot of time. Thank you all so very much. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Okay. You want to take a break? Oh, yeah, let's don't do it. Okay. We can make it up on Monday or some.
Yeah, we'll make it up.
We'll make it up. Okay. All right.
But Mayor, can I say this, though?
Yeah.
In that packet, this is what was important about today. If you recall, in the past, we provided you the list of the capital improvement projects that are coming up. Today was really just to transmit that to you so you have, and we bring it up, it'll come up in the budget process, but I don't want to get the council feeling caught short of opportunity to review the project. So you have in here both the list of projects that are being proposed for the next bond sale as well as the next capital. So the bond sale we're selling for now that are already in the current CIP that we're going to go sell bonds for, that's in here. And then in addition, we've given you the proposed kind of looking forward to next year's capital improvement program. Okay, we'll have a time to discuss it. I just want to make sure you know it's in here
so you can
start reviewing it now, and then we'll make ourselves available to answer those questions in the future.
So the sheet you gave us, the Excel sheet you gave us, the ones that were highlighted in yellow, that's what you have authorization for under current bonds. The ones that are in gray, there's no authorization to sell bonds.
Right.
Right. Okay, just clarify.
Right. So there's one titled General Obligation Bond Sales 2013. So those are projects, and the amounts that we will be selling in the next
April 15th.
So we were trying to get this ahead of to you as early as possible. So you've had this.
And I'm sorry, I hadn't looked at. Is that a combination of the what's left from the 08 bond and the 10 bond,
It includes the
08, 10, and 12.
And 12. Because we've got park projects going on.
Okay. It doesn't include revenue type stuff, which will come through water and those type of things. The revenue bonds. So just GO bonds.
Right. In your packet, you have actually two attachments. Attachment A.
And with GO, of course, I meant general obligation.
Yes, you did. Of course you did.
There
are two attachments. Attachment B is the list of projects that we will be selling 2013 bonds for.
But it includes both. It includes utility bonds and GO bonds.
And GO bonds.
But I know when we sell it, I look back as to authorization. 08 election, 12 election.
Right.
That's
both
correct.
Of them. Okay.
Right. We actually have in the utility revenue, we actually still have some 2006 authorization.
It's,
just, selling
it's our correct. Annual no, utility sale or bond sale.
Get it. Mayor, just Vice Mayor. If we are going to, Vice Mayor, if we are going to call a election for this year for bonds, when do we have to do that by?
Sometime in July. But here's the
so
plan.
A little bit.
So the presentation we have in front of you is showing you what's going to be sold mid-April. We want to get that to you as quickly as possible. There's also a five-year
Attachment A
utility program. All these things we will talk about in the future, but you just want to make sure.
I think fine. That if we'd have just talked about it, we could have finished
no,
it by now.
No, not really. Good luck. But what we will do next week,
next Thursday.
Thursday, we will be making a presentation for transportation, public safety, library, and Phoenix Mesa Gateway Airport about. Kind of give you an update of where we are on the capital program, but also just kind of outline identified needs going forward for the next capital project.
The reason being is that we've been 5 years since our last deal, and so
we want to just bring those to you,
okay?
And then we'll have we were asked to bring that to you at this time, so we're going to bring that to you now.
Okay. Vice Mayor,
and maybe you just said this, but a comprehensive list of the next 5 years of planned but not approved projects for GEO.
They're in there.
And those are in your packet today, and they are attachment A.
I must have missed it,
I'll
look at that. Yeah. All 5 years of it, right?
All 5 years. Okay. So attachment A, anything highlighted in yellow has current authorization, and anything in gray needs future authorization.
In other words, we got the bonds to pay for these. We don't have it to pay for those.
Correct.
Three categories,
Gotcha. All right. Okay, Councilman Kavanaugh.
And again, just before we go into executive session, I just want to clarify that we still have a public safety committee meeting that's scheduled to meet on conclusion of that. And depending on how long the exec session goes and the availability of our speakers, we might revise our public safety committee agenda.
Okay. All right. Just real quick, I just want to mention one thing. I know we're out of time, but thanks to all who made the diving lady. It was really special. We had a chance, three of us. Four of us ended up there. I've never seen such an outpouring from the community. I mean, people were crying when we flipped the switch. It was not because it was bad. They were so emotional.
The first time you did it didn't work.
Yeah, I know. His fault. But thanks to those committees, Vic Linhoff, who has been just a tireless proponent of that, Ron Peters, and there's many, many others I know that I've forgotten, but a great example of a community coming together to do something that, while it seems minor, you know, it's a big deal because it's part of who we are. It's part of our heritage and part of our history, and that's important. So thank you. Mr. Brady, real quick on the
next study session will be Thursday, April 11th, followed by Audit and Finance.
Ms. Nicholson, any request to speak?
No request, Mayor.
All right. We have a motion from Councilmember Summers, second from the Vice Mayor, to enter an executive session. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Going to executive session. Thank you.